So welcome everyone to our fifth and final class on our series, 5 20th Century Houses. Today's lecture is going to be on the Steiner House by Adolf Loos that was in Vienna, 1910. this series that we've gone through over the last couple weeks, today we'll be wrapping up the first decade of the 20th century, which will complete the foundation for the modern movement that is to follow through the middle of the century. Before we get into that, though, I'd like to do a quick poll. Let me pull that up. It's just a simple... simple question. What's the role of an architect? And two options. First option is an architect is an artist creating an inhabitable total work of art. And the second question or second option is an architect is in service of a homeowner, guiding them in the design of their own home. So we'll give that just a minute here. So, looks like we'll end it here. It looks like we have 41% claiming that an architect is an artist creating an inhabitable total work of art, and the majority at 59% believe an architect is in service of the homeowner, guiding them in the design of their own home. So I bring that question up today. I was just curious to see where you'd weigh in before the lecture today, because today's class on Adolf Loos challenges this question of what an architect is, what the role of an architect is. If you recall back some of our past lectures, getting into Peter Brenz in the first lecture, as well as some of the subsequent ones, it was very much about a total work of art. In this concept, and the architect being the artist that executes this total work of art, where they're designing everything from the building structure all the way down to the napkins on the table. And so in today's lecture, we're going to find out that Adolf Loos was not in complete agreement with this concept of a total work of art, and we'll get into more of those details here as we go along. But before we do that, I want to, like we've done in the past lectures, I want to get into a little bit of a background context on a precursor to the house that we're going to be looking at here today, the Steiner House. And Vienna, where this house is located in the 1900s, was in the midst of quite a few intellectual developments that were happening at the time in psychiatry, with Freud, in literature, painting, music, quite a few of the arts. Likewise, Adolf Loos was proposing radical changes in response to architecture and design as well. He rejected the so-called decadent movement that was occurring at the time, and this historicism that was being presented by the Vienna session in his local town there, that was considered decoration to be an end in and of itself. This was a concept that Luys did not agree with. And rather, he proposed the idea that a building must be used, experienced, and lived in for it to really be considered a true work of art. Adolf Luys associated with another gentleman by the name of Otto Wagner, who advocated for the same concept of the style of a house or a piece of architecture being useful. In fact, on Adolf Luys' epitaph that he wrote himself, he said, "Adolf Luys, he freed humanity from useless works." Adolf wrote quite a bit on the theory end of his the concepts behind his work, and in his writings he tried to introduce the Western culture to Austria. The Western culture, in his mind, being the United States and England in particular, but he was providing an analysis of the cultural form that was currently existing in Vienna at the time, at the turn of the century. This concept of this cycle of production and consumption that we've been talking about with the Industrial Revolution that happened at the tail end of the 1800s, as well as many things that were happening politically and culturally and socially as a consequence of this change in the economy, to where this idea of the ideology of free speech this idea of the aristocrat as well as versus the bourgeois gentleman class, and locating in particular modernity as this figure in this class of people, or this gentleman class, so to speak. And these gentlemen being a reflection of the times in their dress, as we're seeing here, this picture of Adolf Luys, as well as a reflection of their conduct, their behavior. All of this stuff in his mind was an expression of this modern man that was coming about as a result of this industrialization. But with this, this was tearing apart some of the structures that were in place prior to the Industrial Revolution. And this tearing apart was precisely this modernity that was coming along in the new century, that was in opposition to antiquity, history, or the traditional ways of doing things prior. And this idea of this conflict between the new and the old, as well as global and local, the impacts of the industrialization on a global scale versus the local context, as well as also concepts more specifically related to architecture as far as exterior and interior. This conflict that was happening in this sense of space related to how architecture defines interior space and exterior space, which we're going to get into quite a bit more detail here today. Also concepts of public and private. These were concepts that were very important to Adolf, and how architecture defines public space and private space. So many of these things were in conflict, or struggling to resolve, going forward, a new order. As Adolf would say, we must orient ourselves by that which has gone before us, but there was nothing there. And so at the same time that he acknowledges that that we have to take heed of what has come prior, he's making the argument that what had come prior is of no significance going forward. Despite Adolf Loos' critique of these historical styles that were very popular at the tail end of the 1800s, this great resurgence of past architectural styles that were getting reborn in Victorian and Georgian and a variety of these styles that he took exception to, believing that this was only looking backwards as opposed to forward. That at the same time, there was again this pull between this conflict of what is architecture if in fact it's not something from the past, and it's not this resurgence of styles, what is it going forward? There was a book written by Charles Dickens by the title of A Tale of Two Cities in 1859 that speaks a lot of this conflict or this this pull that was happening or this turmoil as a result of these changing times in the 1800s. And I'll read you the first opening lines where it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. And so this was this within Dickens' book, was this contrast between London and Paris during the French Revolution. And it was precisely this dying regime and this hope for a new society that was going to come out of the end of this past ruling class. Much of this is what Loos was struggling with himself within Vienna. A similar thing was happening as far as the falling off of the aristocrats and this replacement by this newfound wealth in this upper middle class as a result of these industrialists that were coming along. But more specifically, these paradoxes that Loos was struggling with or this criticism that he was making on culture were not necessarily based on this capitalist mode of industrial production. Rather, it was on a more subjective form of critique of the bourgeois form of life, the lifestyle that this class of people were living socially and culturally, more so than just the economic criticism. In his mind, the modern tragedy of culture is articulated in his texts, the impossibility of reconciling interior and exterior, subjective and objective, and ultimately this culture with a regressive utopia. So in July of 1893, Loos left for New York City. To visit his uncles. He had two uncles outside of Philadelphia. One was actually a watchmaker that lived in Philadelphia that he was going over to spend some time with, as well as another uncle that lived just outside of Philadelphia that was a farmer. And the few months that he was in Philadelphia visiting with these two uncles, he was impressed by this softening in his mind, the softening of class distinction that he was familiar with back in Europe, where society and culture was divided by class. These classes of aristocrats and proletariats and bourgeois. In the United States, this class distinction was not so apparent between a watchmaker, his uncle in the city, and his other uncle, a farmer out in the country. And so this was something he admired that he saw in the United States that he felt was very modern, relative to this idea of classes that was a very historically a very old concept that has been around for thousands of years in Europe. And he found the United States very refreshing in the fact that they have appeared to have moved on from this to where class was at least not so apparent on the surface. He also felt that this democracy that he found in the United States was quite inspiring as well. To this egalitarianism that he spoke of related to his uncles. Also, you might recall from our past lectures, this date when he arrived in the United States, 1893, was the same year of the Chicago World's Fair. And in particular, he told his parents when he left for the United States that was one of his primary reasons for coming to the United States, was to see the Chicago World's Fair that year. And as we're seeing here in this photograph of the fair, this was referred to as the White City because of its, not only because of the lights that would light up in the evening with the fair being one of the first places in the world to electrify an entire region of buildings, but also just the buildings themselves being very neoclassical in style, which is typically would employ white stone. And as you can see in the photograph here, would render the fair almost like a city of white architecture. This really kind of highlighted this in his mind, this neoclassicism that was very popular at the time of this fair in Chicago. This resonated with Luce. He was a classicist himself in the style of architecture that he thought was significant or relevant. So he brought this concept, wanted to bring this concept back to Europe, and his experiences in the United States of what he found, this progressiveness and this modern, this great modern city that he experienced. In particular, we see here the pavilion that was built at the World's Fair by his home country, Austria. And this was something that, if I could read a quote here, he said, "When I left my homeland in order to go to know architecture and handicraft on the other side of the Atlantic, I was still fully convinced of the superiority of German craftsmanship. However, I now still blush to think what a disgrace the exhibition of the German craft industry in Chicago was. All those stylish showpieces, nothing but vulgar fakery." And so this kind of compounding of styles that we see here in the pavilion for Austria, these styles that he railed against, that he felt were, he as in his own words, called fakery, didn't resonate with him. But what did resonate was the transportation building that was erected by the architectural office of Alder and Sullivan which some of you may know was the office that Frank Lloyd Wright apprenticed under during this time period. And he, in fact, actually was responsible for going to the fairgrounds during the construction of the transportation building that we're seeing here, overseeing some of that construction as part of his duties working for Sullivan at the time. And if you recall back from our lecture last week, while he was on site, he would skip over to the Japanese pavilion and watch their construction as well going up. Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for if you'll bear with me, we'll get into that in about 10 minutes or so. I'll elaborate on that a little more depth. So the Vienna Secession that was founded then in 1897, this was a few years after the Chicago World's Fair, back in Vienna, by a group of artists and architects, in particular Gustav Klimt and Joseph Albrecht, which we're seeing here an example of the building that he built for this organization of artists. This was, again, as we mentioned at the top of the lecture, was something that Luce alighted with in some respects, but also in some respects disagreed with. In particular, if we take a closer look at this building here, the ornamentation and the detailing that we see on the surface, he felt was, as in the words of the secessionists, to every age its art, and to every art its freedom, was the motto that was inscribed here at the top of the building. But it was this idea of art almost for art's sake, or even more in particular, the freedom of the artists as this generator of creativity and craft to express himself as an artist freely was something that Luce took exception to. And we'll go into that in a little bit more detail as well. 1903, Adolf Luce wrote an article where he was commenting on this, what we talked about at the top, about this this conflict of times, where Vienna was, in his words, was in a crisis. The decadence and the decline of the monarchy in Austria at the time, and as well as in conflict with this ascending bourgeois class that he, in his mind, felt had no sense of taste or sensibility to taste because of their rapid rise in wealth, not having the cultural history to kind of like instruct them on taste or to develop a taste through a history of culture. And so there was this this conflict and this falling off of culture from this aristocratic monarchy prior that did have a long history of acquiring a taste, so to speak. In 1908, just a few years later, he also gave delivered a lecture that was entitled Ornament and Crime. This was probably his most famous lecture that was also subsequently then published in a pamphlet that we're seeing here, a cover for. And in that lecture, he claimed, he said, "I have discovered the following truth and present it to the world. Cultural evolution is equivalent to the removal of ornament from articles in daily use." And so using ornament on furniture or on buildings or on clothing, masking the mediocrity of culture and social conditions. And so this was this idea that he was putting out there that you could look at the evolution of culture or of the human race over time, and you could see that over time, the removal of ornament or the reduction of ornament in their works, whether it's an architectural structure, or whether it's their clothing that they wear, or whether it's the furniture that they sit on, how ornamental it is or how decorated it is. Over time, as a people evolve, this ornamentation, he believed, fell off and became less and less so. And this was what he was proposing for a more evolved form of architecture going forward, was one without ornament in the traditional sense. He spoke for a bold commitment to clean lines or well-defined surfaces, and in particular, the functionality of objects. And again, this this principle of disornamentation as really being, in his mind, raising the ethical values of architecture, so to speak. And so he was creating this clear division between what was necessary in architecture and what was superfluous. And to read another quote here on this point, he said, "We no longer have the nerves to eat, dress, decorate, as in previous centuries. Modern man has a whole new set of nerves with completely different sensitivities." And so here Luce is speaking of his horror in front of the decorated animals and culinary displays, particularly if he thinks that he has to eat one of these stuffed animal corpse. He feels the same nausea in the face of any excessive ornament. He says, "We have become more refined and more noble. We lack the steady nerves to drink from an elephant's ivory tusk on which an Amazon battle scene has been engraved. Our temples are no longer painted blue, red, green, and white like the Parthenon. No, we have learned to appreciate the beauty of naked stone." And so he was, as we've been speaking, he was directly opposed to this these successive revivals of styles in the second half of the 19th century, which in his mind was living without any form of culture. It was just this hollow form of stylization for the buildings, and was outside of, in particular, was outside of the spirit of the times. By looking backwards and reviving these older styles from past centuries gone by, that they were no longer responding to or commenting on the spirit of the times that they lived in at the moment. And so by contrast to your question that was just raised, he was a classicist the sense of the Greek and the Renaissance classical architecture, an example we're seeing here with the Parthenon. And this was because, in his mind, the classical language or this kind of formal typography or typology from the Renaissance and also reflected in the neoclassicism that was also happening at the end of the 1800s, or also what he saw at the World's Fair in Chicago, was not a revival of a tradition, but rather he felt was actually the continuation of a form of design that never stopped. So it wasn't so much that it was revived, it was just a continuation. And so, consequently, it was in his mind, it was the deepest and most durable form of modernity was to continue this this classical form going forward. He, in particular, in his own work, which we're seeing an example of here, he approved of the decoration and this distinction between decoration and ornamentation. Ornamentation was that he was calling for an end to was in reference to these revivalist styles that were rampant at the turn of the century. But in his mind, decoration could be done in such a way where it was a property of the materials that you're working with when you're building a construction or an architecture. And so as an example here, the brick that we're seeing on the wall, as well as the wood bookshelves, the stained glass over top of the window here, these were all materials that were being used to construct with. Some materials, some of these modern materials like the glass, some of these older materials like the brick, but the materials themselves, by the way that they're handled and their use of the material, could be a form of decoration to the architecture, as opposed to an applied style or ornament that is in addition to the materials themselves. To read another quote, he says, "The functional object endures as long as the material from which it is made. Its modern value comes from its solidity. When a functional object suffers an ornamental digression, its durability is abridged, because then it is submitted to fashion. Functional objects such as fabrics or carpets, whose endurance is limited, remain submissive to fashion and consequently to ornamentation." So Adolph Loos pioneered this concept, this idea of what's referred to as a tabula rasa, or a blank slate, this idea of working with the materials at hand without looking backwards in time or in history, and dealing with the materials in their inherent properties moving forward in design. And in particular, because of this, looking inward towards the material, it's this idea of working in a design from the inside out. And he applied this not only to the materials, but he also applied this to the actual architecture that he was creating. And so by the age of 32, in 1903, he had furnished by this point dozens of apartments, the interiors of these apartments. And so, interestingly enough, his career as a designer, as an architect, started out designing interior spaces as opposed to exterior buildings. And so as a result of his practice in interior designs of these apartments, like this one that we're seeing here, it created a mindset or a process to where he works from the interior of the space outward, which is in contrast to a more traditional form of architecture that works from the exterior form and works inward towards the interior spaces. And so in 1903, he then starts the design of his own apartment, which we're seeing here, which coincidentally he would live within that apartment for the rest of his life. Loos valued this craftsman tradition that we've been seeing the last couple of weeks with the Green brothers in the Gamble House in particular, but also William Morris out of England. This idea that we spoke of quite a bit in the Gamble lecture about William Morris's country house as being a model for architecture, this craftsman style, arts and crafts, was something that appealed to Adolph Loos. He very much liked this aesthetic of the craft and the tradition of the craftsman, and as he said, an architect is a bricklayer who has learned Latin. And so he rejected these artists or these architects that were around him that saw themselves as artists, that had this, as in like the Viennese secession, that believed that the freedom of the artist to express themselves was something that he felt was not applicable to designing a space for another individual. He felt that the architect's role was more of serving a user of the space, must be able to build his own life in his own privacy, his own form of privacy. And so the architect was really just assisting in this execution or in guiding them through this process. More specifically, this idea of a psychological space that reflects the individual that occupies or inhabits the space, which is very different from the public space on the exterior of the building, as well as we're going to see here going forward, that works its way inside. He recognized in these changing times the need to preserve privacy in particular against these exhibitionists of the media and social networks that were thriving at the turn of the century, much like we're seeing here today, something that's still with us. And in particular, he felt that architecture should be an object of use. Creating these interior spaces of privacy was a way to use the space almost in an objective way, enabling the living within that space as a fact of culture and sensitive perception of life against this simulation or this false ornament or these stylization that he was railing against. So if we pull up the floor plan here of his apartment and take a little closer look at it, we can see that it's divided into three spaces. Over here on the right-hand side is what he referred to as an inglenook. There's a fireplace here in the center. On center of these, the openings here that pass through laterally. And then he has here a living space with tucked in the corner a table for eating, as well as then on the far left-hand side, a bedroom here. And in his mind, this concept of this new interior idea of looking at space, architectural space as an interior aspect, would protect the individual within this comfortable space, a continuous sequence of spaces, as we're seeing here, where each space flows one into another. In particular here, I'll point out, some of you might recall back to the very first lecture with Peter Brenz, when he had the pocket doors that would tuck into the walls here, that afforded the ability to open the doors into the walls and make the space flow one into the other, or pull the pocket doors out and close that space off. Luce is using a similar strategy here, but here in this case, he's using a fabric curtain. But nevertheless, the same concept of this flowing space, continuous space between the two, is something that he's also exploring here. This is a term that he referred to as a Romplan system. And at the same time, as we spoke of previously within the Brenz lecture, this idea of enfilade, where the spaces pass one into another without the use of a hallway to separate them, was also something that he was very much exploring as well. This is taking a look at this table that's tucked into the corner of that living space. And he very much, Luce was very skilled at not only speaking, but also writing. And he wrote in one of his publications of his trip that he made to the United States, where he asked an American lady what she thought was the most noticeable difference between Austria and America. And she answered, the plumbing. In this respect, America is to Austria as Austria is to China, he said. And here, Luce was arguing that Austria was lagging behind America, not only in cultural progress, but also in technology is within plumbing. It was not uncommon at this time period in Vienna for these apartment flats to not have indoor plumbing, whereas at the turn of the century, this was something that was sweeping through the United States, or at least the larger cities within the United States. Much more advanced. And it goes back to this idea of, in his mind, this personal hygiene being a reflection of a modern city or a modern man was this idea of cleanliness and concern for cleanliness. And some of you might recall back to our lecture last week with Wright when he was making the same observation with the Japanese and the Shinto religion and their praise for cleanliness. And so he goes on to say, an apartment without a bathroom, an impossibility in America. The idea there is a country of millions at the end of the 19th century whose inhabitants cannot bathe daily is a monstrous one for Americans. Actually, we do not need art at all. We do not even have a culture yet. The state could act as a savior in this regard. Instead of putting the cart before the horse, instead of using money for the creation of art, it should be used for the creation of culture. Next to academics, they should build public baths. And next to the professors, they should hire bath attendants. A higher art will follow the creation of a higher culture, which will reveal itself with or without the help of the state. And so here we see him criticizing, again, Vienna being falling behind the United States from a modern perspective, and also, in particular, going back to the same theme that we've been seeing in these subsequent classes, in particular, the first class with Peter Brenz, where he felt that art and these art houses that they were trying to create in this colony could elevate the society and culture by extension. Here, Luce is making the claim that if we elevate the culture by providing plumbing, for example, to the people, this would by extension elevate the art. So he also made the distinction that modern this modern culture that he was referring to was not a temporal term. It's not a modern in reference to a time period or a sense of time, but it was more a qualitative concept in his mind. He said, one is only dressed modernly if he can be in the center of culture at a specific occasion of the highest society and not stand out. An apartment must never be completed. Are we human beings ever finished, complete in our physical and psychological development? Do we ever come to a standstill? And if a human being is in a constant movement and development, if old needs disappear and new ones arise, if nature as a whole and everything around us is always changing, should the thing that is closest to the human being, his home, remain unchanged? Dead, furnished for all time? No, it is ridiculous to lay down to people where a thing should stand, design everything for them from the lavatory pan to the ashtray. On the contrary, I like people to move their furniture around as it suits them. And it is quite natural when they bring the old pictures and mementos they have out into the new interior, irrespective of whether they are good taste or bad. That is not at all important to me, but for them, they are charged with emotion and intimacy. That is to say, I'm an architect who designs his interiors from a human perspective and not from an inhumane, artistic one. I'm astonished how many people let themselves be controlled by these so-called architects for interior design. And so here we're seeing a picture of this Inglenook in his apartment, and you can see the fireplace here. There's a copper hood, the triangular hood that's over top of it, reflected here in the lamp off to the side here, the same type form. The Inglenook is surrounded with his library of books. But also in particular, notice how there's this built-in seating here that's tucked back into the corner. This idea of comfort that he feels is central to an interior space, of creating a space that is not only comfortable, but also inviting comfort. I also point out here on the ceiling, these dark stained oak beams, exposed beams. These were added to the flat ceiling. They're non-structural. They're more visual to create, again, this look of this English country house or this arts and craft type cottage that he was fond of in this arts and craft appeal. You can see here in color, also the paneling here off to the side. In the living space that's adjacent to the Inglenook here. And you can see he brings this dark wood paneling up along the side of the wall here. You can see the railing where the curtain rod, where the curtains are hung to close this space. And also the stark white plaster on the walls. Also of note, down on the floor, a hardwood floor, but covered in Persian rugs. You can see here in this image the curtain itself that he draws closed when he wants the space to be secluded. You can also see the brickwork again on surrounding the fireplace here. All of this. Again, this materiality that he's bringing in and using this to design to decorate the space, not an applied ornament on top of the materials. But most importantly, this idea of the furniture being comfort and the ability for a fast and effective relaxation. This idea of a space and a furniture designed in such a way to maximize the speed at which you could relax and find comfort within the space. He goes on to say that architecture arouses sentiments in man. The architect's task, therefore, is to make those sentiments more precise. The room has to be comfortable. The house has to be to look habitable. We see here that the Americans, in his mind, had a carefree attitude towards sitting in their posture, unlike the European customs. He goes on to say, at the moment we not only demand of a chair that we can rest our bodies in it, but that we can recover our energy quickly in it. Time is money. This resting has to become specialized. After mental labor, one needs a different position for resting than after exercise in the open air, different after gymnastics than after riding, different after cycling than after rowing. And there is something else. Different degrees of tiredness demand different techniques of resting, and this in order to accelerate recuperation. Is achieved by using several different types of seating, one after the other, with several different positions and postures. Have you ever felt, especially when you are extremely tired, that you wanted to hang one foot over the armrest? In principle, a very uncomfortable position, but at times a real relief. In America, he goes on to say, this relief is always obtainable because no one thinks that sitting comfortably, that is recovering quickly, is inelegant. There you can even rest your feet on the table, as long as it is not used for food. Here, however, there are still those who are offended by other people making themselves comfortable. And so speaking of comfort, we move on to the bedroom within his apartment. This was a bedroom that was designed for his wife, Lena, his first wife. And in this bedroom, he wanted to not only provide shelter, this basic concept and need for architecture, but he also wanted to, in fact, provide a very sensual space. And so as a result, his bedrooms were draped with these white linens, as well as along the walls, but as well as covering up even the cabinetry within the rooms, the dressers and the built-in armoires. And behind this, the rug on the floor, which was made of rabbit skins, rabbit fur, would extend across the floor and up onto the bed. And so here we have this this soft material that is essentially completely covering every surface of the room to, again, this idea of a softening of the space as of the architecture. In this case, he's achieving this with the rugs and the curtains and the tapestries, the upholsteries. And this is in contrast to the more traditional harder materials like marble and granite, brick, that were seen in the other spaces of his apartment. He goes on to say, in the beginning, we sought to clad ourselves to protect ourselves from the elements, to keep ourselves safe and warm while sleeping. We sought to cover ourselves. Originally consisting of animal furs or textiles, this covering is the earliest architectural feature. And so here he's making he's drawing clothing and the use of clothing on the body as being really one of the original forms of architecture, and this idea of that the interior of a space is much like a dress or a casing that protects the individual and in particular provides comfort to resolve this psychological split that we've been speaking about at the start of the lecture here between the individual and the social, social being, the public face and the private face. And so with that, we're going to take a brief break here for about five. Yes, sure. And what's the question? Yeah, so as I mentioned at the time, the indoor plumbing was not as common in Vienna at the time. So his apartment did not have those facilities. It was a shared communal space that the apartments in the building would share. And so within his apartment complex, if we go back here to the floor plan, you can see. You can see the division of the space here, the ingle nook on the right-hand side with the fireplace, as well as the living space here with the eating table in the corner in the bedroom as well. So very much, again, this was specifically when he went to the United States and experienced the fact that all these units had plumbing. He recognized immediately that when he came back to Vienna that they were still relative to the Americans, were living in an older era. They weren't as modern. Great question. So with that, we'll take a 5-minute break. It's 10:55 right now. We'll come back at 11 o'clock. So before 1910, the majority of Adolph Loos's commissions were these interior apartments that we were taking a look at here with his own apartment before the break. 1910 was the year that he received this commission that we're looking at here today, this Steiner house. And this was a detached house where he would not only design the interior, but also have an opportunity to design the exterior. And going forward, his commissions were largely these houses where he could take in these ideas of considering the exterior space, whereas the apartments that he was designing prior didn't afford him that luxury. And so, in fact, he referred to himself in this time period prior to 1910 as almost, in his words, an outfitter or a tailor, to where that was his role as an architect, or in related to architecture, was more of a tailor, tailoring the space inside. And so moving forward with the Steiner house, the house, he would say, does not have to tell anything on the outside. Instead, all of its richness should be disclosed on the inside. So here he felt that the interior, what was going on the inside, again, something that he was very, he felt was the source or the key component of architecture was the interior, having come from that in spending his time working on the interior spaces prior. He felt that this was a kind of luxury that was held in reserve away from the public. These richness of materials on the interior, colors and sensuality, but also psychologically dealing with the private life of the individual on the interior, their thoughts and their dreams, their fantasies, everything that, so to speak, that has to be defended against by the intrusion of the public, or the press, or the police. And so 1910, he received this commission from Hugo and Lily Steiner that we're seeing here. I'll point out here on the front facade, even though the exterior appears to be symmetrical in design, if you look closely, you'll notice that there are some subtleties. The two windows flanking the doors here are different sizes. The sill a little bit higher on the right-hand side than the left. And so he's he has some of this very classical form of symmetry that's informing his exterior design. But at the same time, he's also exploring some other nuances. In particular, what's unique about this particular building is, as you can see, is this rolling, rounded rooftop that's quite distinctive in its style. And this was in response to a zoning issue, to where buildings or houses could only be two stories on the front facade here on the street side. And despite that, they wanted to create a four-story building. So if we go to the rear, we can see here over on the left-hand side the curving roof form here on the street side, but on the back side, the garden side, you can see, in fact, four floor levels here that were built up. And this was a device or a trick that he was able to utilize in section. You can see it clearly as well, to take advantage to achieve a much taller house, with much more space on the interior stacked up on four floors, despite the fact from the street that it reads very much just like a two-story building, by this softening, again, of this roof form, this curved roof form here. Again, a common theme related to this softening of space, as well as the architectural form itself. We saw just before the break in the bedroom with the use of the soft materials here. He's doing it with a hard material, but with the curvature, is able to render it visually as a soft form. We also see that the facade is covered in this vine that's growing and taking over the surface. This is a Japanese ivy, which would just crawl right up the plaster surface, the smooth plaster surface on the exterior. And this, he felt, was almost symbolic of not only this idea by having this ivy growing up the side of the house sheltering the inhabitants or the interior space from this from nature or the elements on the exterior, kind of visually demonstrate here with the ivy, but also in particular the ivy also he felt kind of spoke to this concept that we talked about in the bedroom about the materials becoming almost like clothing. And in this case, the ivy almost acting as a piece of clothing that's covering the building itself. And so this idea of clothing or a dress or fashion, so to speak, being in his mind one of the earliest forms of architecture. If we take a look at the exterior without the ivy, we can see the strong cube form of the design, very strong, crisp lines, blank facades, and this starkness was really the aspect of this design that really set it apart and created such a stir within the architectural community. Was this austere blank facade, and if you recall back to the first lecture with Peter Brenz when we talked about his decoration that we saw the arts and crafts ornament on his house, but the plaster infill between the ornament was really what caught the eye of the profession at the time. And so here we see Adolf taking it even further. He's completely eliminated the craft or the trim work on the exterior, taking the field, the plaster field, right up to the edge. To where, again, going back to his idea of ornament and crime, to where he's completely eliminated all form of ornament on the surface here. And this was something that was novel and a new direction that we're going to see going forward throughout the century within the modern movement. Speaking of the facade, this smooth lime plaster, which was a Viennese tradition, he said the house must be discreet from the outside. It reveals its entire richness on the interior. And so if we move on into the interior to take a look, we see here in the entry hall, this idea where he's also done a similar thing on the interior that he did on the exterior, where he's purging all of the interior of this ornamentation that has been applied by the architects of the day, and so the space becomes almost empty, as we saw with this apartment. The decoration of the space is really just by the materials themselves, but here he's as we look at it. The entry hall here on the left, and then as well as in the distance here in the center, a writing desk, as well as off on the right hand side, a reading niche with a bay window here, flanking the books in the library. Each one of these spaces here become defined by the use of the space. The sitting and reading here off in the niche, or the sitting at the desk in writing. Or sitting at the table here in the entry hall, greeting someone that comes to the house. And so, again, he's defining the space from an interior perspective, how the space is being used by its inhabitants, as opposed to imposing how the space is being used from like a top-down approach of the artist or architect that he rails against. The He had a term that he created that was called Raumstimmungen, which is a room moods. And the idea of creating, using the materiality and the furnishings in the the space to create a mood within the space. He says the true artist, the great architect, however, first of all, gets a feeling for the effect he wants to produce, and then he sees it in his mind's eye, the rooms he wants to create. And so here he's trying to create a mood that he has arouse a particular feeling for the space. And so he would go on to say that what does the architect really want? He uses materials to arouse these feelings in us, which are not inherent in those materials themselves. And so it's by the use of the materials and the way that he uses these materials to fill out the space that he's able to create the feel of the space. As an example here, we'll take a little bit closer look at the lamp that's hanging within the entry hall. You can see that he's also doing a similar thing with the decoration on the lamp itself. It's not an applied ornament. He's using the straps that are holding the shade together as the decoration itself, much the same way that he handles the materials within the space. And if we take a look at the floor plan, we can see down here at the bottom the entry into to the house, and then off to the right here is this entry hall that we were just exploring, a set of stairs here that goes up to the second floor. Here's this little reading nook here off to the right in the bay window. If you head down past the writing desk down the hallway here, you enter into this large open space in the back of the house. And this large open space, again, much like his apartment, is this idea of the flowing continuous space from right to left. He's got over here on the right-hand side, just like in his apartment, he's got a little ingle nook here wrapped in around the fireplace. And at the far side, he's got his dining table, much the same way in his living room in his apartment that was tucked into the corner. And so if we actually take a look at this, here we're seated at the dining table, looking across this space. You can see the fireplace here at the end. You can also see he's using the same strategies with the curtains, dividing the spaces, the three spaces apart, or drawing the curtains open to have the spaces flow into each other continuously. Much like we saw last week with Frank Lloyd Wright's Robie House, where the space runs continuous, uninterrupted. I also point out here at the end, you can see this little footstool here. And if we take a little bit closer look at it, on the left-hand side was a footstool that was created by a company by the name of Liberty and Company from the 1880s through the 1910s. Here on the right-hand side, Luce asked one of his carpenters to replicate the design of this stool that was being made, factory made. And this was a common thing with Luce, where he frequently did not design the chairs or the furniture within his spaces. He would either buy a piece off the shelf, or he would have it replicated. He would copy a popular style. And so we see an example here of a corner chair that would be used to tuck into these corners to, again, going back to this idea of an inviting space. Here he's a Chippendale dining room chair. Again, he felt this, how could you improve on a Chippendale? It worked and functioned as it was needed at a dining room table. And so it is just as easy to actually use those chairs as opposed to reinvent the wheel. Taking a look at the dining room space here, you can see off in the distance here, you can see the use of a mirror reflecting back. And this was a way to kind of make the space feel larger. But also he was using it in a more psychological way within the space As he said, he lowered the mirror down to eye level, so when you're seating at the table, you could see yourself within the mirror. And by doing so, it was almost holding a mirror up to the family, to where one could not come and sit down with the other members of the family without a clear conscience. And so he's using the architecture here in a way to really not only form the behavior within the space, but again, going back to trying to create a feeling or a mood within the space. And so if we go, we take upstairs, take a look at the second floor here. You can see if we continue on up the stairs here on the left plan, we arrive at the central hall here. Down on the left-hand corner, the front left-hand corner is a studio space, an art studio space. The Mrs. Steiner was an artist, painter, as well as a graphic artist. And then also we have the central space here was a for a butler. And then the two spaces over here on the right were children's rooms, bedrooms. A bathroom here, a shared bathroom between the bedrooms, as well as the master suite here over on the left. And so if we take a look here at the master suite itself, you can see the bedroom, much the same way that we saw in his apartment, the built-in units that are up against the walls. Here he's not rendering them as soft with the drapes, but nevertheless, it's this complete integral furnishing to the space that is the common theme here. He goes on to say, speaking of the bedroom, he says, the bedroom is the most sacred, the most private affair. No outsider may desecrate this sanctuary. The bedroom should not have a door to the common rooms. So this idea of a removed space, this being the most private space in the house, being the most removed from the more public spaces within the house. And so then finally, I'll conclude it here with one last quote by Luce, where he says, the house has to please everyone, unlike the work of art, which does not. The work of art is a private matter of the artist. The house is not. And so with that, I wanted to, in the last few minutes that we have here, I wanted to just to, this being the last lecture, I wanted to kind of recap very briefly, go back through the five houses that we took a look at here. This first one here, the Brenz house by Peter Brenz in Germany. This was in 1901. And in particular, as we go through this here very, very quickly, I wanted to speak to the common theme that we had across these five classes of this impact of industrialization to where this new industry of machines afforded a lot of new materials, glass, concrete, and steel, as well as wood paneling, veneers, all these, like, so to speak, plastic materials, this plasticity or this softening that's occurring within the materials from the more traditional rigid stone and brick. But not only that, but also just the methods of construction were also being modernized at the same time. And so if you take a look at, as we go through these here, just very quickly, if you take a look at the this transformation that's happening in the materials as well as in the methods, but in particular, architecturally speaking, the elements of the core elements or the essence of architecture being the roof, the walls, and also the doors. You see the handling of the roof and the walls and the doors here as we go through these five houses, how they change one from the other. Again, this being Peter Brenz's house, if you recall back from the second lecture, Casa Batlló by Antonio Gaudí, this was in 1906 that was complete, and we could see here the roof that was being softened, almost an Art Nouveau in Peter Brent's house. Here it's becoming completely deformed by Gaudi in his, to where it's a completely organic, irregular form, shape, deformed, so to speak. And if you recall back to that lecture, this idea of a softening of material, rendering the material as not its inherent properties. This particular roof being made up of tiles, very rigid ceramic tiles, but nevertheless looks almost as if it's soft to the touch because of its form. The third lecture, we took a look at the Gamble House. This by the Green Brothers out in Pasadena. This was in 1909. And we can see here the roof, in this case, cantilevering out over this the day bedroom here out on the porch, out in the open, which is significant as well, with the day bed for slumbering during these warm summer days. But this roof line here, very much speaking to this arts and crafts, as well as also the long overhang projections that we see in the fourth lecture with the Robie House, Frank Lloyd Wright in Chicago, in 1910. And again, the strong roof line here, Frank has taken it in a much more rigid fashion compared to the softening that we saw with Gaudi and Brenz, but nevertheless, he's exaggerating the cantilever and the projection, taking it much further than the Gamble House in Pasadena. Then finally, the lecture here today, Adolf Loos Steiner House, again much in the same tradition as Gaudi. He's doing a softening of the roof. Here he's using a regular geometric circular form. But nevertheless has the same effect that Gaudi is striving for, where he's softening the edge. And this softening goes to a point, just to kind of also give you some context now that we've wrapped up this course, going forward, where this foundation that these five houses kind of laid at the turn of the century, they're really precursors to this modern movement that's going forward into the 20th century. And so I thought I would give you a little bit of a glimpse to some of these houses going forward, with the idea that this course would be followed up with a subsequent course of five additional houses in the mid-century, and then finally wrapping that up with an additional five more houses at the end of the century. And so I'll briefly here just go through, giving you a little bit of a sneak peek here to the five houses that we would be taking a look at in a subsequent class. This is the Schroeder House by Gerrit Redfield in the Netherlands in 1925. You can see here he's taking it and he's really abstracting the house, as you can tell, into a total form of artwork, a piece of sculpture. Some of you might be familiar with Mondrian's paintings. This was an inspiration to him, as well as he inspiring his paintings. And so we see the roof line, as well as the openings, the doors and the walls, being abstracted to the point where the division, the distinction between the two has become blurred. Follow that up with Le Corbusier's Villa Savoy in 1931 in France, where we see, again, a further abstraction, the articulation on the roof of this wall here becoming almost a form of ornament, defining the roof. In this case, the roof almost becoming blurred as well, where the roof is. If you look through the windows here, you can see you can see the sky beyond. To where it's almost as if the roof has been lifted off of the house and is absent, just the same way that the house itself has also been lifted off the ground here on top of the columns, the pilotis referred to. Third lecture would be a house that you're very familiar with, I'm sure, Falling Water by Frank Lloyd Wright in 1937. Again, also, he's picking up where he left off with the Roby House, the Prairie House. Here, he's evolved the Prairie concept into the organic, a much more evolved concept involving additional response to the environment around that the house inhabits, almost to where the house, the intent of the house is to become completely organic itself, to where it blends seamlessly into the surrounding natural terrain. Fourth house in this series would be the Farnsworth House in Illinois by Mies van der Rohe. Some refer to it as the glass house, where this idea of the house taking the roof line as well as the floor as slabs and separating them between infilling them with glass, taking advantage of this modern material, glass and steel, to where almost the walls disappear. And so where we have with Corbusier making the roof disappear, here we have Mies playing with this idea of the walls disappearing. And then finally, the fifth house in this series, Frederick Kiesler's Endless House from 1951. This was a concept house that was never completed, but it was a model form of it was erected within MoMA in New York City in 1951. And this idea with the Endless House was a house that takes a form to where the walls and the roof and the floors become so organic in form that there's really no clear distinction between one and the other. They blend together. If you recall back to our lecture on the Roby House last week, this was something that Wright was trying to achieve with the Roby House, where the walls seamlessly transitioned into the ceiling without a clear break. This is something that Frederick Kiesler in the Endless House is really taking to the next level in his execution of this concept. So then finally, just in the closing minutes here, go through real quickly another last set of five houses at the tail end of the century. And this is this time period after kind of the modern movement has fallen off. These last five houses we just looked at was really the high point of the modern movement. And once this fell off, we entered into a period that's known as the postmodern, traditionally, but some critics and historians today are also referring to this more lately, even more so into this new century that we're in now, as this idea of the end of architecture. And so here we have Oscar Niemeyer's house in Rio de Janeiro from 1953. And you can see here, this is actually a reference to Mies van der Rohe's glass house, the slab ceiling, slab floor with the glass walls. But here he's making the slabs much more organic in shape and form as compared to Mies's strong rectilinear space. Louis Bergen's house down in Mexico City in 1968. This is the Egerstrom house. This was a house that was incorporated with a horse stable. And here we see the absence of the roof in this courtyard and the, again, also playing with the wall forms, the openings in the walls to where he's breaking down the wall in the division of the wall and becoming much more sculptural to where the wall and the roof are starting to disintegrate here. Carlos Scarpa in this house in 1979 in Italy. We can see here, much like Falling Water that we saw with Wright, here he's letting the house fully integrate with its environment, letting also, as we saw here today with Luce, with his climbing ivy across the surface of the Steiner house. He's doing a similar thing here, but he's also exploring materials as well as organic forms in this case, again, also trying to take it down a similar path of Wright with his organic architecture. Finally, last two houses here, Frank Gehry's Lewis House in 1995. This was a theoretical project that went on for years, informed quite a bit of Gary's work. His other projects was the design of this house in particular, but this house was never realized, much like Kiesler's Endless House was a concept house. But nevertheless, has quite a bit of ideas that are explored in here that speak a lot to the development of architecture and has informed and pushed architects, his colleagues forward just by the work on this house. One of those colleagues being Zaha Hadid, and this project here called Ice Storm, which is her exploring the complete blending together of the architectural structure as well as the interior furnishings and functional space. Here you can see the use of a table in a bench seat here for this table, for example, and how it blends seamlessly into the structure around it. And so much the same way that we saw with Luce today, where he was trying to build in the furnishings into the structure and try to combine them together. Here, Zaha is taking them to the furthest degree to where they become blended to become one. And in particular, beyond just the furnishings blending with the building and structure, by extension, the direction where all this is going is also the same idea of the architecture itself blending with its environment, its natural landscape around it, to where the two of them are no longer distinguishable between them. And this is precisely what Zaha tried to achieve with her buildings, where the landscape and the so-called architecture are indistinguishable from the two of them. So with that, we're a couple minutes over, but if there are any questions, definitely could take some if they're hanging around. Yes. Yeah, no, that was intentional. And actually, there were some other things that we didn't get to point out within the Steiner House, but there was some other Japanese influence as well. And it ties back directly to Wright from last week, since Adolf had gone to Chicago's World's Fair. He did see the Japanese pavilion, and it had an impact on him just the same as Wright did. And also, I'll point out, something I didn't touch on today, but Luce was familiar with the portfolio that we talked about last week with Wright that was published in Germany through Europe. He did see his portfolio, and that did have an impact on him, as well as a couple of his students that were studying under Adolf Luce. He did encourage them to go to the United States and to look Wright up and to work underneath Wright to learn from him. And so not only the Japanese influence, but also Wright's influence was something that definitely filtered into Luce's work. Yeah, it's the PID email that I sent out to the class at the beginning with the syllabus. Okay. Yeah, let me pull that up here just a minute. What were the questions related to the kitchen? Right, exactly. That's to the point. That much like the plumbing, it was a communal shared kitchen. That's right. Yeah, teaching. Actually, it's the end of architecture is the name of the class. We actually kind of jump ahead of what I just outlined here today, of kind of like the two classes that kind of that continue from this series that we just finished. We're kind of actually going to leapfrog over that into the 21st century and take a look at some of the architecture that's actually happening today. So that's the end of architecture is the name of that. The question on my email, it's Matthew with two T's dot Schlueb, which is my last name, Schlueb at pitt.edu. Yes, it's Matthew. Actually, I can put it into the chat. It's Matthew with two T's. Dot Schlueb at pitt.edu. And yes, definitely if you have any other questions, please do email me. I'd be happy to respond to them via email after this class wraps up here today. So with that, we're quite a few minutes over, so we'll wrap it up and want to thank everyone for taking the course. It was definitely a pleasure to present the material to you and look forward to seeing you again in a future class.